Ernie Coons. And I remember thinking that's Mr. Dress Up.
Right.
I didn't know anything about William's past at the time, but I read his chart, and there wasn't really a whole lot in it as far as the diagnosis. There was a diagnosis of unspecified infection, and some one medication, nothing else for any sort of mental health issues. It was just she was on what's called furosemide, which is a fluid shift drug. It's prescribed for people that have either fluid retention with swelling or congestive heart failure, which wasn't on his chart, or liver disease or issues with the kidneys, which is kind of common. Kidney disorders are kind of common in that genetic type. He was in a private room, which is usually reserved for infectious diseases. Those rooms are rather small. They have a double door with a curtain, and they have a negative flow of air that can be set up. And there was no infection protocol in place. The negative flow of air wasn't turned on. I wasn't told to wear a mask or a gown or anything.
So in other words, there was no indication he was actually infected with anything from the basis of what you were...
There was a high white blood cell count. There was something going on, but it wasn't contagious.
Right.
So when I first talked to you, that was a bit of a surprise. I'll just finish with my observations from what I remember. You have to understand I have an uncanny photographic memory when it comes to things in particular that I write, and this is pretty much what I remember seeing on the charting I did with him for 4 days in a row, and what I remember reading of the previous day's charting. So he's on this drug for swelling. I observed little to no edema, no swelling. He did report being sore all over. He did have a couple of bruises on his arm, not particularly deep ones, but that I do remember reporting them. And there was one bruise that I did see on his side, by his wrist. He never had an IV fluids in all the four shifts I was with him, when it should have been, because he did have low blood pressure and low potassium, which is indicating of either too great of a fluid shift with the LASIK, or he came in with low blood pressure. I remember trying to get him to drink a little bit of water every 30 minutes or so, because I knew that because of his low blood pressure, I wanted to get more fluid, more blood in his system, because he was reporting so much dizziness. And
was there an explanation why he wasn't on an IV?
I did try to ask about this from the first shift onward, and the first couple of times that I asked the head RN that had called me to the unit, and she did read his chart and went and talked to people about it, but I never saw one put in. I wasn't an RN. I was an LPN. At that time, we weren't putting in IVs.
Sorry, what's an LPN?
My licensed practical nurse.
Okay. Now, tell us a little bit about some of the anomalies you've noticed. You know, mentioned when we were talking about a lumbar puncture in his back, but no record of it on the chart,
yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, so he went to the bathroom a lot, and that's when I would see him. I would go in to help him because he was so often so dizzy. And that was the first time that I saw the Band-Aid on his lower back, which was exactly where... it was the exact location that you'd get what's called a lumbar puncture. Now, in our 2 years of school, you know, we study all the tests and why you have certain tests, and it doesn't take a lot of detective work to, he's had a lumbar puncture. the next time I left the room, I checked his chart. There wasn't any previous charting saying a lumbar puncture was going to happen, and there wasn't any results sheet in the chart saying anything about returned results from an LP. So he definitely had had one because he had the headache and he had the dizziness. And so I did ask him.
I was going to say, is that unusual then for him to have had one and there be no record of it?
Yes. Yes, it is. I knew the unit clerk very well that was there. She was actually a former LPN herself. In fact, she was such a attentive to patients' needs unit clerk that she kept her LPN license active to be able to help us at a moment's notice. In other words, if there was a report or anything that chart had needed, the flag would have gone up on the side of the charting, and she would have been there and put it in. So I am not sure what happened.
Well, this must have been leaving you kind of feeling confused about the situation.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, in the back of the chart, there would have been... you know, if he'd been transferred from another hospital, if it had been done there, I remember flipping it right to the back to see. There wasn't even anything that was saying he was at another hospital and had had one done. But if he'd had a Band-Aid there, he had it done within 12 hours.
So you think that happened to him somewhere else in St. Paul's Hospital?
It probably happened to him in St. Paul's. I don't know how long he was in there before I was called in. I have a feeling that I was called in fairly quickly after his arrival.
Yeah. I just had a question from a listener come up. She asks, what was the reason given why he had a lumbar puncture?
Perfect. A lumbar puncture is the secondary diagnosis test for tuberculosis and a number of other sort of dormant or other types of meningitis, things that can go into the bloodstream, into the brain. That can, So there's the I'm sure people remember the little skin scratch test for TB. That's usually what they do first, and then they do an LP. If that's negative, if they have reason to believe that the person has tuberculosis, it is quite serious that if a person is out there in the public with active tuberculosis, because you can get it within 3 feet of them talking.
Right, but you didn't see any indication of tuberculosis by him. Did he have any of the symptoms?
No. I had no... Tuberculosis wasn't even looking at the LP evidence. It wasn't even in my mind. I had undiagnosed infection, a very weak, dizzy headache, sensitive to light, no fever, despite his high white blood cells count. He certainly was not coughing, and he certainly had no blood in his sputum. Every day, I listened to his chest. I asked him if he had any pain when he breathed or when he moved in his chest, and he said no. And so there's no evidence that he had any form of tuberculosis. I only found out from talking to you that the cause of death was tuberculosis meningitis.
Well, that took us 5 months to get it took us 5 months to get the city coroner to release the coroner's report, and the cause of death said tubercular meningitis. Now hold that for a moment, because I wanted to mention the fourth thing that's the anomaly here, this meeting that you were called into. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So on about the last shift I was with William, I did about four shifts in total. I was called out of the room by the head RN again. And she called me out of the room, and I went out because some things you don't want to say in front of the patient. I have no idea. She just asked me to come out, so I came out. And on a constant care shift, you're usually supposed to stay in the room. So I was mostly in there. Plus, I like talking with him, and he seemed to like me around. Anyways, I go into the hall, and she says to me, there's a meeting, and you're being asked to come in. And I at first thought, oh, it's a family meeting. That's the only meeting that I've ever been asked to go to without the patient there, is some sort of family meeting, where usually the doctor is there and some family members, and they sit and all of you sit and talk about how the patient's doing.
Right.
You know, and it's not necessarily about mental health. It's usually about their care plan, you know.
Okay.
So I walked into the room and I saw no family. And there was three people sitting there. And one worked at St. Paul. One had a badge, and I had never seen her before. And the two others had no badges that I could see. One was wearing a full suit, you know, white shirt and everything. The other one was wearing a suit jacket with a sweater underneath it, slightly more casual. But that gentleman looked Native, but not not the more Southern Native. He looked more like the Northern Native. So he looked a bit different.
There were two men that you'd never seen before there.
Never seen them before.
Did they identify themselves?
No, they went straight into it. They went straight into it. The one that looked Native was staring quite heavily at me, had very thick eyebrows, and I just immediately was like, okay, this is very serious. You know, I was thrown off by family not being in there and the doctor not being in there, never seeing that other woman. So the first thing they asked me was, William been talking about? And I just literally, this also threw me off. I felt like it's very difficult for me to remember this meeting compared to my time with William, because it just didn't feel right. I kind of ignored him, his question. I didn't even like to look at him, really. You know, what had he been talking about? And I just went, I asked him why he didn't have an IV in, or any antibiotics for his infection. Did they know what he was infected with?
Mm-hmm.
And they ignored my question. I didn't get the feeling they were concerned for his physical health.
Well, there was no evidence they were even doctors, was there?
No, there wasn't any, you know, psych consult ordered. That would have been in the charts again.
Okay.
And these weren't, I knew the people that did the rounds for psych consult. These were not any of them. These were, except for the woman, these were people from outside the hospital.
And what else did they ask?
They asked me again in a different way, more in a medical terminology. What's his mental status? They used mental status, and instead of what has he been talking about? And my hackles were so up at that point that I said the only thing that I knew to say to keep him from going to a psych evaluation, which was he was having no suicidal ideations and no mention of doing harm to himself or anyone else. That's what I said. I just, somehow I felt protective of him.
All right. Now, let me just add something here for the listeners. What I was told by William's partner, May, who had accompanied him to VGH, because after he was with you at St. Paul's Hospital, he was sent to Vancouver General Hospital where he died.
Yeah, that's where I was informed that he had passed away.
Right. Now, when William went to VGH, apparently within 12 hours he was pulled off life support. He went into some kind of coma, and they pulled him very quickly off life support without even consulting the family, and that's how he died. Now, you were telling me that family permission is not required. If I've got this right, if the person is mentally incompetent, he can become a ward of the hospital, and they can make that decision to pull him off life support. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. I had the unfortunate experience of my charting having committed two people to that.
So I don't do it lightly. No. But do you think there's a connection between them asking about his mental state and that issue of who was it who could have pulled him off life support?
Absolutely. I don't see how they could have done it so quickly, though. Perhaps that's why they put him with me, because I did have a reputation in the medicine floors for getting quote unquote difficult patients to sort of open up.
Right.
You know.
Well, because people don't like to speak English, because. Thank you. That was the late Pauline Weitzinger, just died a few years ago. One of the four grandmothers arrested at the Sundance on 4th of July. Oh, God, it's not 4th of July, the counter-revolution of 1776. But.
Crash, oh mother, crash.
down to them, you know.
Okay.
You got to meet people where they are, right? If you're trying to help them, you have to sort of talk them into wanting to help themselves. And just so much of this felt wrong. And I remember William's energy, and it sticks with me to this day. You know, there was one shift with him that is probably why I stood up for him and felt defensive of him. He had called me into the bathroom. The door was closed because he was going a lot because of the Lasix makes you go to the bathroom. Plus, I was trying to make up for no IV by giving him water. He called me in there, and I knocked on the door. Okay, I'm coming in. And he was sitting down, and he said, I'm dizzy. I can't get up. I feel so weak. I feel so weak. And I said, okay, it's all right. We'll get you up. All right. And I gently helped him up. I mean, he was so sensitive to the touch, right? Like, you know, I practically had to hug him. So wasn't putting any one part of me too deep into his...
Mm-hmm.
So I got him up, and he got his hand up on the sink, and he's facing me, but he's not looking at me. He's looking at the floor. And he says to me, "Go quiet," but I heard it. I'm just an animal.
I'm just an animal?
I'm just an animal.
Speak episode 3.
Why do you think he said that?
I know where it hit me. It hit my heart. It hit the floor.
Used to work building cars on the assembly line. When she heard a warrior speak of a better day to come, quit her job, traveled west to the land of the setting sun. Survival school she organized and gathered history. Cooking food, chopping wood for the elderly. When she left behind two children young, asking forgiveness from the Creator when the day was done. And a man, a man, a man, a man. We can hear your spirit call. And a man, a man, a man, a man. When the rain begins to fall, we can hear your spirit call.
I'm from the Mi'kmaq tribe of Nova Scotia, Canada. Would you describe what happened to you this past Friday morning on the Rosebud Reservation? I was awakened around 5 in the morning by someone saying that they were the FBI and that I should immediately come out, and I was in bed, and I just heard a lot of voices all around, and then I heard someone say, "Let's just cut open the tent," you know, and I was trying to get out of bed and over at the door before they start cutting the tent, and when I walked out, I saw 2 FBI agents standing there with M16s and pistols, and then I was told to go over and stand amongst a group of women that were standing in front of the main house of the residence of Al Running. And I didn't know what was going on. Even then, I knew that they just came in and, I don't know the correct word to use, raided or busted or just pillaged or... You know, they were just all over the place, dumping things and and just tearing things apart, and they just had everybody all over the place, you know, with some had handcuffs and some didn't, and everybody was standing around half dressed. And so I went and stood over there, and they came over and put a pair of handcuffs on me and took me into the house and searched me, and they told me that I was going to be arrested and that I would be deported. And
in September 1975, FBI agent David Price attempted to force her to sign an affidavit implicating Leonard Peltier for the murder of the two FBI agents. After she refused to cooperate, Price promised her she would not live to see the new year. In order to protect herself, Anna Mae went underground, and she told many that the FBI had offered her money and immunity to turn against Leonard, but that she'd rather take her kind of freedom than whatever they offered her. Up until her death, it is a proven fact that she turned to aim for protection and had put her fears of the FBI in writing. When her body was discovered in February 76, law officials and FBI agents, including David Price, investigated the cause of her death. They cut off her hands for fingerprint analysis, and despite the visible bullet hole in the back of her head, they determined her cause of death to be from frostbite. They quickly arranged for her to be buried as Jane Doe. The second autopsy was ordered by the Wounded Knee Legal Defense Committee. Wounded Knee Legal Offense Defense Committee and Anna Mae's family when her identity was revealed by the FBI. Her body was re-dug up, and an independent pathologist discovered a gaping bullet wound in the back of her head. It was easy for him to locate and remove the .32 caliber bullet lodged in her head.
On the trail of broken treaties, Anna Mae, she took a stand. Building bunkers and wounded knees, defending sacred land. Slipping in, slipping out behind the lines with supplies late at night. Where the grandfather shielded her from the SWAT man's gun sight. In the month of June, in Oglala, the FBI did come. On the very same day that the BIA stole the land of the setting sun. In a firefight, they killed Joe Stunts, and this is what they said. Anna Mae, we will see you dead. Anna Mae, Anna Mae, Anna Mae, Anna Mae. We can hear your spirit call. Anna Mae, Anna Mae, Anna Mae, Anna Mae. When the rain begins to fall, we can hear your spirit call. Miles from the nearest town, a body was found with a turquoise bracelet on her wrist, frozen to the ground. Standing by the FBI, could not identify the body of this woman who they haul in one too many times. So they took the turquoise off her hand and cut them off at the wrist. Sent her hands to Washington, they sent for fingerprints. The doctor said she was drunk, fell down, simply froze. I buried her with the name Jane Doe. Oh, Anna Mae. Oh, Anna Mae. Anna Mae, Anna Mae, Anna Mae. we can hear your spirit call. I must say the people cried for the enemy. For sin, the FBI to bring her from the grave. What they found was a bullet hole in the back of her head. While the FBI put one more notch in their gun for one more dead. And Oglala wind blew last night to the sound of the drum. Heard the voice of enemy speaking in a Mi'kmaq tongue. There's no force made by man that can stop the driving rain. When people fight for their land, you will still find enemy.
I know why he said it now in hindsight, but instinctively in the moment,
yeah,
my heart hit the floor and I said to him, "No, William, no, Ernie." I said, "We're the animal. That's white people. In fact, animals are better than us." And a little smile came on his face, and he looked at me and he laughed. Real quiet.
Sounds like him, yeah.
And it was the day after that that I had the meeting with the with the
right. Now let me. We're at the bottom of the hour, and I want to get on to other aspects of this. But let me try to summarize here, and let me tell me if you think this is accurate. Because from the other information we had, and one of the questions from the listeners, what's the reason given as to why William was summoned to St. Paul's in the first place? I was told by his partner May that he was ordered by Native Health to report very quickly to St. Paul's Hospital. And
yes,
he was escorted there by RCMP officers. In other words, it was forced. He didn't have a choice. They said, "You are going down to St. Paul." And the question of his name as well, his brother Ernie, he had a brother named Ernie Coombs who had died at the Kamloops Indian Residential School. And William had told me that Ernie had been killed by a priest there. And yet William is given the name of his dead brother when he's admitted into St. Paul's.
And I was made to use it. And there's so many implications for that aren't good. Just by using the name of a dead relative with someone is a trigger to kind of bring them back to that time in their lives.
For what purpose?
And to trigger the feelings that he had had. I knew about the residential schools beforehand. That's possibly why my heart sunk so bad when he said that. But I didn't know that he had been in one specifically. I was getting hints at that point, but so that's and to give someone a dead person's name, you know what they do with that. That's to sort of, you're already dead.
Absolutely. And also, if anyone's trying
That's
to trace
awesome.
Him, you've got a fake name, and it's harder to trace. Now, let me just put something here to you.
And that's to protect patients. Oh, my gosh.
Well, okay, so it looks like everything you're describing, that he was brought in and he was deliberately medically killed. Is that
Yeah,
unfair?
Well, let me...
Yeah.
Let me explain this about the TB infection protocol. So if someone has been alerted to be actively having TB out in the public someplace, the cops do have the right to come and get you for tests. What I would like to know at this point, given you or I mean, maybe you were around, did you ever see him spit blood into a handkerchief? Did you ever see him cough a lot?
No. As a matter of fact, based on that clip I sent you of his interview done just a month or two before he was in the hospital, he was on the mend. He had stopped drinking. You see, we had been engaged in protests, and he had been on my radio show at the time. He was feeling very up and confident. He had stopped drinking. He was on the mend, definitely. His whole sense was much more powerful. And odd about how it all happened so quickly, you know.
Well, give a person his brother's name and forcibly take away his rights as a human being, make him feel like an animal by forcibly making him go to the hospital in a tiny 10x10 room with a strange Scottish stranger.
Well, let's work on the assumption then that he was killed. How exactly did it happen then, do you think?
Well, after you told me what he had died of, you know that I proceeded to, you know, I'm no longer a nurse, but I certainly, that part of me was in me, the detective part, medical detective now. I started to look around into it. Tubicular meningitis is the result of what's called TB disease, and he didn't exhibit any of the TB disease symptoms unless someone can report that he had blood in his sputum, blood in his mucus when he coughed. And that is the fatal form of tuberculosis. TB is a shorthand for tuberculosis. Either way, TB disease or the other milder dormant form of it, TB infection, which can sit latent, dormant in someone's body for a while, and they can show no infection. But what's interesting about the TB infection is that it doesn't, only 5% of the cases don't get it, active TB, within 2 years of exposure. Now, from that, one of the other interviews that you had done, recorded with William, I heard him say that the priests used to punish the kids that weren't being compliant with them by putting them in the unit with the sick with TB kids. They deliberately exposed them.
Yep.
And when I heard that, that's when I researched the TB disease and the TB infection, because I knew that there was a dormant spore form of TB that could hang out in the body and just sort of be in the lymph and then move occasionally elsewhere. But again, both of these forms of TB are treatable. And that's why they do this. We've got a suspected TB person out in the public. Go grab them and bring them in for treatment. That's why they do that with the cops.
But there are no symptoms, and, you know, why do you think he would die so quickly? Why would they pull him off life support or VGH if he didn't have any of those symptoms?
Because they wanted him to go away. I, you know, it's not the first time. I've got a pretty long road since my time working at St. Paul's, and it's not the first time I've seen literally diseases pop up out of the blue when a person is beginning to be strong, to heal, to speak out about injustices. I've seen this before, and I know it sounds funny, and I don't want people to think that it's, you know, that this is demeaning my report of medically trained observations that I've been given, that I've said today.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just, you see patterns, right? And it's a pattern I've seen. I've seen, there's another virus that can sit latent in most of us. It's there. It turns into shingles later.
Mm-hmm.
It also causes paralysis. It can sit in the big nerves in your body and just turn on like that. You know, but this wasn't a case of that. He'd obviously developed a resistance to the tuberculosis because he didn't get it within the 2 years after he was exposed as a child. The only thing that I can think that has occurred is when we have someone that we count that yes, the police could have brought in, or that have come in for another reason to the hospital, and we discover that they're positive with the TB skin scratch test, we immediately put them into isolation and check everybody else that was in the four-bedroom with them.
But
that's,
you didn't
that's
do that.
The protocol, right?
With William, that didn't happen with William.
No. Someone someone, someplace, said Williams is suspected to be contagious, TB infected person.
But that,
right?
Of course, was bogus.
So, but the hospital based tuberculosis cases, the nocosomial, the ones that have been the hospital bugs. People have heard this. There's hospital bugs that are like nothing else in public. They're the resistant to antibiotics. They're the most salacious, right? You've heard of, everyone's heard of MRSA or VRE, right? These different staph-based things. Well, it's the same thing for tuberculosis. We can, it's rare, but what I'm trying to infer here is that in that hospital, there was probably vials of blood, of sputum, that had a very strong form of TB, and he could have been exposed.
Could have, but there's no... The thing, just going on your experience, the diagnosis or the cause of death didn't in any way correspond to what you observed.
No.
Okay, that's the.
He would have been coughing for at least 3 weeks before.
Right.
He would have had chest pain. He would have had blood.
Okay. Now the other thing is, if the thing about the lumbar puncture on his back, which we talked about earlier, if they went in there and found nothing, then they'd have to obviously make no reference to it in a report if later they were going to give it as the cause of death tuberculosis. They'd have to hide the fact that he didn't actually have it. Would that be accurate?
That would be logical, yes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So the thing about this whole incident, and the final thing which listeners need to know, is William had been an eyewitness to that abduction at the Kamloops Catholic School in October 1964. He had talked about it on the air. He was in the process of being brought over to London, England, because that summer there was a tribunal being held in London where he was going to give testimony. 2 days
he
after I leave,
none of this to me.
Well, 2 days after I leave for Europe, he's called into the hospital, and this all happens. So I don't think any of that is coincidental.
Illegal possession of explosives. It's illegal possession of dynamite, and that all happened within a matter of 15 minutes. That all took place, and I stood there, and they just continued to. I could hear things crashing inside the house. They were evidently moving large objects like furniture, I would imagine, refrigerators, bureaus, or chests, because I could hear things falling off, breaking, smashing, and I could hear comments coming from them inside, oh, look at this, or they would laugh at something, and then they were joking to one another because one couldn't move a dresser by himself, and you'd hear somebody going over and helping them, and something would smash, and then it was just like a bunch of, I don't know, you know, just, they seemed to be having an awful lot of fun, you know, they seemed to be enjoying themselves, and you could look anywhere, and you could see them doing the same thing to the vehicles. They were just pulling things out and dumping things and just throwing things on the ground that were useless to them as evidence, and whatever they could find that they felt that they could use for evidence, they were marking it down, and whatever they felt that they couldn't use, they just threw it to the side, you know, and they didn't have any respect for the value of any of the other contents other than what they could use for evidence. I would assume that's what they were doing, and while I was standing there with a group of women waiting, I was just being verbally harassed by some of the agents. They were implying that they had been looking for me for a long time, and that they were very pleased that they finally found me, and then they were referring to they were accusing me of a number of things that I have not done, And they said so many things to me that I know I haven't done, that I just stood there because I just didn't know why I was being arrested, or because they told me so many different things that I did, just didn't know. I just knew that I was being arrested. And they told me that I'd be in Canada by the afternoon, that they were going to deport me, and I was in this country illegally. And I tried explaining to them that I wasn't, and they just totally ignored me. They insisted that I was here illegally. And then during this, there were two young Indians that came up to the roadblock, because they had a roadblock just past the Al Redding residence on the main road. They had a roadblock, and we heard some loud shouting, yelling, and the other two women that were standing there with me, we were talking amongst each other, and we were saying, well, what's going on? They're yelling at someone over there. And then we heard, you know, if you keep going, you know, we're going to shoot you, you know. And the other woman that was standing there, you know, she got pretty nervous, because she said, you know, that somebody's going to get shot, and if that ever happens, you know, everybody's going to start shooting, and then it's going to be called an accidental shooting. And she was really scared. And it turned out that there were two there were two Indians. I could see them walking into the driveway, and they were handcuffed, and the agents were trying to stop them from coming in. And but they walked in, and they were met by about four or five agents, and that turned them around and started pushing them. And we were just standing there. I couldn't even watch any longer, because I was being distracted on the other side by all the smashing that was going on in the house, and the ransacking of the vehicles, and just looking into everything that was outside, you know, food containers, and even looking through a little place that was secluded on the side for one of the female dogs that had a litter of puppies, and they were even going through that, and they were just every place, you know, just picking up things. And finally, you know, I heard the helicopters going around up in the air, and I could hear all the radio messages going back and forth, and the agents are coming over, just asking me questions over and over and over again. And they finally put me in the car, and they put a different agent in there with me and gave him a pencil and a piece of paper, and he started asking me the same questions they had already asked me, and then he'd add on more questions. And they finally, I guess, understood that I just didn't want to talk to them, so they put a woman agent in the back seat of the car with me, and we drove out towards the driveway. And they were taking me to pier, and but on our way from the running residence, we had to pass Crow Dog's residence. And so therefore, the agent that was driving the car pulled into the Crow Dog residence, and when I drove in there, you know, there were agents all over the place there. They had people standing up against objects, and they had women and children outside all standing around in groups, you know, partially dressed. And then the agent got out and spoke to the other agents, and then he got back in the car, and then they drove off. And then when we passed the other roadblock, which was on the other side of Crow Dog's residence, before they crossed the Little White River Bridge, they had another roadblock there, and then we stopped there. And then the agent told the agents that were there that he was taking me into pier, and then they just peered into the window, and then they made comments towards my name, making it appear as though they all knew me by name, and they were remarking that I was a bit surly today, and they drove off. And they drove me all the way to pier, and when I got to pier, they took me to the federal building,
took me upstairs on the third floor, and they put me into one of the small offices, and I don't know how long I was in there, 45 minutes, and the agents were coming in and out, and the two-way radios were going off and on, and there was a woman typing away, and there was a radio going, and every once in a while they'd come in and they'd ask me something, and then finally they had one agent came in, and he sat down and he showed me his card and told me his name, and he started asking me questions totally unrelated to what I was being arrested for. And I told him that I wanted to talk to someone, I wanted to call someone so that they can send somebody up here to help me out, and he told me that I could not make my telephone call unless I talked to him first. And I told him that, they can't do that. And he said, well, you're not going to get a call through unless you talk to us first. And he said that he was talking to me about another situation which had absolutely nothing to do with why I was being arrested. And he started referring to the June 26th incident that happened in Ogallala, where three people were killed. And first he said, I want to talk to you about an incident that happened in Ogallala on June 26th, where two men were killed. And I told him, well, there were three. And he said, okay, three. And he was a bit unnerved about my referring to the fact that there were three rather than two, as he had told me. And he started referring to other things that had absolutely nothing to do with me. And he kept insisting that I used to live there where the incident took place, and I kept insisting back to him that I have never lived there, and he just wouldn't believe me, and he just kept asking me questions like if I knew Harry Jumping Bull or Cecilia Jumping Bull, and I've never had, the opportunity of even meeting these people, let alone knowing them. And I just refused to talk, and so he left me alone. But they would periodically come through and ask me something, and then finally, after I was there about 3 hours, and they finally took me over to the county jail in Pier, and while we were driving over there, the agent kept reminding me, he kept asking me if I knew what I was being charged with, and I was just using the memory of what they told me that morning, which was, I know what I'm being charged with. I'm being charged with illegal possession of dynamite. And he said, yes. And do you understand what that means? I said, yes. And he wanted to know if I wanted to talk to him. I said, no, I don't. He finally got me to the county jail, and he told the jail keeper that he had to call the federal building. And so he did, and he returned, and then he had it written on a piece of paper what I was being charged with, and which was different. And he says, you know what you're being charged with? He asked me that again. I said, yes, illegal possession of dynamite. And he says, well, this is your charge. And then he showed it to me written on a piece of paper, possession of a firearm with altered serial number, which was totally different than, what they told me I was being arrested for. And then he asked me if I understood that, and I said, yes, I understand it. I told him I didn't at first, and he explained it to me, and I said, well, then, yes, I understand. And he just kept standing there asking me if there was anything more. And I just said, no. And he said, are you sure there's nothing more? And I said, I'm sure. And he said, you don't want to say anything else to me? And I said, no. And he said, you don't want to talk to me? And I said, no. And the jailkeeper said, well, is that it? And he said, yes, I think so. And he'd look at me and he'd say, isn't that it? And I just kept insisting, yes. And I didn't want to talk to him. And so they finally took me up to my cell upstairs. And I would say within an hour, I heard someone opening the door, and it was a woman came in, and she called my name. So I got up out of bed and went over there, and she introduced me to a U.S. Marshal, and he told me who he was. He gave me his name, and he gave me a piece of paper. So I looked at it, and it was a subpoena. I was being subpoenaed for the grand jury in Rapid City, and it had on there the date and the time that I should go there, and then he left, and so I went back in my cell, and I was to stay there until later on that afternoon. They took me down to the federal building again, and to my surprise, that's when I found out that there were six other people in the same jail with me, because I didn't know that. I was the first one that they took away that morning, and I didn't know where they took anybody else or who else they arrested. And when they took me out of the jail to take me over to the federal building that afternoon, that's when I saw the rest of them. They were all chained up with the waist and handcuffs, and they were chained together in these green, coveralls, I guess. And they were all put in a car, and they were going to the federal building, too. And we got there, and since I don't understand any of the very many legal terms or legal language, I asked what I was being taken there for, and I still don't remember what they told me. I've never gone through anything like that before. I've never been arrested like that, and I just didn't know what was going on. And they took me down to the federal building, and I went in front of the magistrate, and there was an attorney there for me, and I don't know, they were just talking about, they set bail for me, that's right, and they set it at $5,000, and they took me back to the jail, and then the following day I went up for a bail reduction, which was at first denied, and with the comment that my lawyer was telling the magistrate that $5,000 is an unreasonable figure for me, because I there's no way that I can get up that much money. It's just totally impossible. I have absolutely no resources whatsoever. And he said, well, that's right. And my lawyer, told the magistrate that I would have to, just sit in jail. And the magistrate's reply was, yes, that's right. That's exactly what you have to do, is sit in jail. And finally, they continued talking about whether or not I was actually guilty of the charge, and I think they realized then that that was not a place to be discussing that, but, a courtroom is where something like that has to be discussed and proved. And finally, they asked me for my own personal statement as to my past work here in South Dakota, and I told the magistrate the work that I have been doing in Oglala, and he still denied it, my bail reduction. But finally, he was told, because he did make a statement stating that I had been indicted, and my lawyer said, no, she has not been indicted, and to his, he was really surprised. He said, oh, you haven't been, and then he looked at the, I don't know if it's a prosecutor, I think that's what you're calling, and but I know he's not on my side, and he asked him, he said, she's not been indicted, and he said, oh, no, and evidently that totally made a different, circumstance for him to make a decision, because he then said, well, one of the conditions that we can release her on would be under the custody of her lawyer, which would be, 10% of her bond, and certainly made me feel happy, because I knew I'd never be able to raise $5,000 sitting in jail. And so from there, it was just a matter of waiting until people finally got together $500, and I was released on bond. And now I'm working myself, trying to raise bail money for the rest of them, which is $5,000 each, and I know that it's money that they cannot raise, because not one of these people, has $5. I can honestly say that they don't have even $5, let alone $5,000. And my whole purpose now is to raise funds, and also raise or to have the press concentrate on this whole incident, because to the best of of my findings lately since I've been out is that this incident started way before Friday morning when the raid was conducted. I hear that there have been a lot of things that have been taking place in Rosebud that led up to this, and also we are not allowed to have outside attorneys out of the state of South Dakota. And yesterday, before I was released, the magistrate appointed a South Dakota lawyer for me, whom I don't know, and who knows absolutely nothing about the raid, why the raid happened, or he only knows what I have been charged with, and that is it. And I do have some people that have been willing to help and for counsel, and I don't know how that's going to turn out. But hopefully I can get some press coverage, you know, that will reach across the country and help financially and support physically. And because it's very critical that these people and myself, that we get a fair trial. And because it's something that has been involved here for a long period of time. It just didn't start Friday. You know, it's something that has... the injustices that have been going on the reservations here in South Dakota have been just continuing, and the only way I feel that they think they can stop them is to arrest everyone, throw them in jail, and they feel that that's the end of the problem, and I don't think that's no solution to any problem. Jails are not a solution to problems, and so that's what I'm doing now.
What was the FBI's excuse for coming to the running home?
They gave me absolutely no excuse. As far as I know, after consulting with my lawyer, I then found out that they had search warrants, and the search warrants were... they were looking for a particular number of things, which I don't remember, but they also had warrants for the arrest of five of the people because of a supposedly an assault and battery charge that has been signed, a complaint that has been signed by two people who are non-Indians.
Did the FBI make any racist or insulting remarks to you?
The FBI most certainly conducted themselves in with the attitude that they are a racist. During their search, they emptied medicine bags and threw about medicine pipes and confiscated eagle feathers and varieties of beadwork and those objects that are used in sacred ceremonies. They just dumped and allowed to just fall off of objects, and they just didn't seem to care. They seemed to feel that, or they showed that they had absolutely no respect for these objects. I myself, for one, when they were trying to remove my medicine bag in the jail, I refused to remove it, and they told me that I can take it off. The boogeyman isn't going to bother me, and it's an insult, and they don't have the ability to to be able to comprehend that another people has another belief other than what they have been believing or practicing, whatever it may be. They seem to feel that if you don't, if they're not familiar with what your beliefs are, and then they use that to ridicule you, to criticize you, to make fun of you. They were making fun of a woman that was praying. They were snickering at her, and you know, the FBI don't have any respect for these articles, and you know, the people are really worried because they want to know why they want these things. Why are they confiscating these things? You know, what do they plan on doing with these things? And I think it's a very serious matter, when it touches onto these objects, because it definitely shows that they have absolutely no respect for a religion or a belief that another nation has, and that's very discriminating, that's very racist, and they don't have the ability to just allow someone to believe in something else, something that's totally different, something that may be even totally alien to them. The fact that they don't have to understand it, they don't have to be a part of it, but I think they should have at least the respect, not for, I wouldn't ask for respect from them, but I think they should be able to at least respect themselves, to at least have the ability to be able to allow someone the freedom of believing whatever they want to believe in. And one of the things that I have forgotten here is when I was taken into the federal building in Pier several times, each time I walked into the main corridor, the lobby downstairs, they had these Join the American Revolution flags plastered all over the walls. And to me, that was such a hypocrisy. You know, they are asking this country to join in on a revolution that they feel is totally justified for whatever reasons they may have had when they decided to pull away from whoever. You know, they feel that that's something you can celebrate and that you should be proud of. And in turn, they themselves can at the very same day look upon a nation and ridicule them for what their beliefs are. And I do feel that this is something very important. I have seen that there is something that is disturbing the agents very much. They're very frustrated or angry, or there's something wrong somewhere. It is not only the raid that they seem to be interested in. There were a lot of other things about Indian people in general that they are very, very concerned with. The American Indian movement, they are very, very concerned with that. And I think it's not just arresting those that they went there to arrest, because they included a lot of other things, the religious items that they took and the ridicules and the remarks that they gave, which are totally unnecessary. I think is a very serious, it's coming out, and it's very, very serious. I think that they most definitely want to destroy a nation if it will not subdue to the living conditions of a so-called reservation, and those that do not want those kinds of conditions for their children or for themselves, then I think that they definitely are out to destroy that concept of freedom. And that's it.
No, not 2 days after you're leaving. No. I found out he died the month that he died, which was pretty much a month after I took care of him.
Betty, and that is Erica Kelly, retired nurse, former employee at St. Paul's Catholic Hospital in Vancouver. She tended to the targeted residential school activist William Combs just before his unusual death in 2011. She witnessed the events that point to William's probable death by foul play. She's discussing medical genocide, methods of psychic assault used against targeted individuals.
And then about, within that next year, I think close to, you know, the fall of that year is when I found your website and read about all this and put it together. And it was quite the, oh my goodness, or oh my, you know, it was like, I know him And I left messages on at the time you were doing shows with Wilfred. Alfred. I left messages, comments under his videos and stuff.
Oh, I never got them.
I know. No.
Of course, yeah. He did a sabotage number.
Alfred doesn't pay a lot of attention.
But, you know, it's interesting, too, that same spring is when I was deported from England. When I was over there in May 2011, after William had died, I was imprisoned at the Stansted Airport Immigration.
It sounds like they're all working in cahoots, whoever
yep,
they are.
Banned from the country, yep.
That goes along with, of course, Elizabeth Windsor joins Stephen Harper and Ratzinger, the Nazi Pope Ratzinger, hiding out in the Vatican under Pope Franco, who issued the Omerta. Anyway, they, about 30 and growing, have ICJ warrants for genocide, for murdering half the children sent to church-run boarding schools. Half the native children in Canada.
That's that's where I've kind of gone with this. You know, this was a good wake up call for me. William changed how I practiced as a nurse, and it pretty much changed my practice so much I couldn't do it anymore.
Right.
I couldn't hold people down. I couldn't calm them down after some cowboy, you know, had come in and done something to them and didn't explain anything. It was taking too much out of me. I missed the job. I missed the people. But I don't miss the medical machine. I saw a lot of stuff in there. I saw a lot of good stuff, really good stuff too, but the negative is what sticks out. And I saw a lot of nurses and the doctors too, but they do it more sort of slyly. But I saw a lot of nurses making fun of and jibing at the marginalized people, you know, the street people, the poor people. And I didn't like that. And in about that year that I met William, I started to stand up for it. But I really stood up for it after him. It's just, there's an epidemic of being mean to the ones that are down, and it's so opposite to what we're all supposed to be in that profession for, and it always seemed like they were getting some enjoyment out of it, like they were getting some energy from doing it.
Well, I want to get into that a little bit. We've only got 7 minutes left. We'll have to carry this on, I think, in another interview, because there's other aspects to this that we won't have time for today. But there was one thing that happened to you. Do you want to talk about the incident after William had died?
Mm-hmm.
That occurred to you?
So I wasn't working at the hospital anymore. I was riding my bike home, and I think I already had discovered your blog and had read about this point. But I happened to be riding my bike past the VGH hospital on 10th there, just past where the emergency is. And there's an odd statue there that I hadn't seen before. And I can't seem to find anything on it on the internet about its title or who's the artist that created it. But I just glanced at it as I'm riding up the hill. And as I glanced at it, I got like this, like, feeling like I'd been tasered in the forehead. It was really strong, and it hurt. And just kind of shook it off and rode the rest of the way up to the top of that little hill and stopped at Oak Street there. And pressed a light because it was not to cross the road, because I lived up at 16th over by Burrard. And as I'm up on the sidewalk, I had kind of gone around the back of a car, and I guess the fella had thought I'd gone too close to his car. I didn't touch it or anything. From the back of it, not the front of it. And he starts yelling at me. And I'm just like, what? And he's yelling at me. And then the light turns, and he goes quickly, like puts on the gas right behind me on my bike, and there's a, more than one bike crossing and people crossing. And I quickly realize that he's chasing me. And I've rode my bike around Vancouver for, you know, 20 years, right? I've never had something like this happen. So I go to turn to go up alleys and go ways that a car can't follow, cutting between apartment buildings where I knew that there was a wide enough path to go down on my bike. And he comes down the alley. And I couldn't believe this. My heart just starts to pound, and I keep riding. And at one point, I almost hit him because I came out of a place he couldn't go, and he was just right there. And it was just the strangest, oddest thing. And I thought about it, like, what did that statue have to do with it? It was almost like something had turned on in this person, because there was nothing. There was no reason. I didn't cut him off. I didn't swear at him. There was no reason for him to chase me home like this.
It was like he was being directed. Mm-hmm. It was like he was being directed.
Yeah, definitely like it was being directed. I was in a space of healing, of getting stronger myself, like William was. Because I needed to not work at St. Paul's anymore. And it just, that's another pattern I've seen, is people who, once they're getting stronger, once they're healing, and during the work of expressing that healing, which usually, you know, inspires others to do their own healing work, I see people time and time again get something else happen to them, a sickness or some sort of financial attack or psychic attack. Yep. That was a psychic attack. But that was just the beginning of the unfoldment of wake up calls to how much this happens out there in the world with compassionate, intuitive, intelligent,
you mentioned
justice people like yourself.
When you say psychic attack, you said when you saw those two guys in suits, the two strangers, the men in the meeting. What impression did you get off them? What was your impression of them?
She was putting out a bit bitchy cold energy, just to be thorough. The Caucasian fellow sitting in the middle was officious, and the dark-haired, bushy-eyebrowed northern native looking fellow was downright malevolent energy. He was trying to intimidate me.
So what do you think is, when you're talking about psychic attacks, psychic energy, what's going on here, do you think? Do you want to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes we have left?
Well, so we've got like 5 minutes, right?
Well, we've got about 5 minutes, yeah, 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah. It's a long story, and it's basically from where I'm at this point in my life, well over the decades past all of this, there's a war in our minds and our hearts going on. There has been a long-standing, almost hidden, or not hidden, but not believed history of abuse and division of family from each other, of humans from any connection to each other. We see it now, but big time with all the technology and the cell phones, but I'm talking about William's statement of, I'm just an animal. I think many of us who've had sort of a not-so-pleasant childhood can relate to that feeling, and I think that the vulnerable state of someone who's been in a fight-or-flight situation, of feeling like anything could happen, that their lives are at risk, for any period of time is purposefully done to the very ones that are the most full of spirit.
Yeah.
And are humanity's warriors. I didn't know William as a strong person, but I know that you're a warrior, and I know that I'm a warrior, and I know how much I've been attacked. You know, been called a bitch, been called pushy, all sorts of other things. Sorry, but I'm not supposed to swear.
Sure.
For standing up for myself or others around me. And I know you've been accused of things that are also completely inverted to who and what you're doing. And they seem that these attack, sorts of attacks seem to be reserved for just the ones of us that are actually doing something. There's a lot of people out there talking.
Yep.
There's not that many doing something. And the ones that usually are doing something don't have much. They don't have a lot of money. They don't have, they're not high in politics and you've got a lot of clout, you know, as if that matters. You know, they're doing it out of the goodness of their own heart and knowing that it's right. It's what just to do. And we're the ones that often get this sort of projection of the exact opposite, even accusations that you are the very group that are doing this.
Right.
You know,
no, of course. It's the inversion and the misinformation. But
yeah.
I want to have you back again, Erica, and we can talk about this in more detail. It really needs a whole show about this aspect of it, which was very much directed at William because he was a spirit dancer. He was from that tradition. Of this being, he was a spiritual elder.
Revolution, not since the day of the 4th of July. Well, yesterday I borrowed Tristan's wheels for my trip back to where we met after Big Brother shot his brains out in Palestine. Oh, Funa Bombs has been using his bike till he gets better. And if you meet me there Monday at noon, at the railroad crossing 5300 Port Chicago Highway, we can non-violently stand in the way of dropping the biggest WMD since Nagasaki on our Tech Fury allies in Syria. Well, we dropped the WMD in Afghanistan, but we're bombing the Syrians in alliance to help the advances of the Tech Furies, the 40,000 death squad. Well. Let me just finish out Kevin Annett and see me next week, Tuesday noon, 104.1 FM, Berkeley Liberation Radio. Info.
Talk about that. I want to thank you. Unfortunately, we're at the end of the hour almost, and I want to thank you for your very important witness and the words you have today. And thank you for your courage in coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to honor him by coming out in support of what happened to him at that end, because it was mysterious to me, and I'm very grateful to be able to shed a new light. And again, if anyone has anything else that they can share about any sort of thing that might have looked like pneumonia or anything, please let Kevin know.
We're going to be... this is an ongoing investigation, as with the death of five other members of our network in Canada who died under similar questionable, obvious foul play circumstances. So, Erica, thank you.
At least now you know the name that they had him in there as.
Yep. Erica, thank you. We'll have you back again. Thank you for being on with us. Bye for now. And just to close, I want to read to you from William's statement, the reason he was killed. This is his words. I'm an interior Salish spirit dancer and I'm 58 years old. I'm a survivor of the Kamloops and Mission Indian schools, both run by the Catholic Church. In October 1964, when I was 12 years old, I was an inmate at the Kamloops school and we were visited by the Queen of England and Prince Philip. I remember it was strange because they came by themselves, no big fanfare or nothing. And as a note, the Queen was in Canada in October 1964. We checked in the official records, so it's accurate, date-wise. Continued the quote, but I recognized them, and the school principal told us it was the Queen, and we all got given new clothes and good food for the first time in months, the day before she arrived. The day the Queen got to the school, I was part of a group of kids that went on a picnic with her and her husband and some of the priests down to a meadow near Dead Man's Creek. I remember it was weird because we all had to bend down and kiss her foot, a white-laced boot. After a while, I saw the Queen leave the picnic with 10 children from the school, and those kids never returned. We never heard anything more about them and never met them again, even when we were older. They were all from around there, but they all vanished. There were 7 boys and 3 girls in age from 6 to 14. They were all from the SMART group in class. 2 of the boys were brothers, and they were Métis from Quesnel. The last name was Arnold. I don't remember the others, just an occasional first name like Cecilia, and there was an Edward. What happened there was also witnessed by my friend George Adolph, who was 11 at the time, but he's dead now. That's from our ITCCS.org site. There's more information on William. And again, I urge you to get our book, Fallen, The Story of the Vancouver Four, off Amazon under the name Kevin Anna, because that's where you can read a lot of the personal encounter I had with William that led to this medical murder of him at St. Paul's Hospital and Vancouver General Hospital. Until next week, follow our work, murderbydecree.com, itccs.org. Write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com, especially people in Vancouver, with any more information on the medical murder of William Arnold Coombs. Until next week, brothers and sisters, stay strong, stay clear, keep up the fight. I thank you.